Turning it over to Leanne Nurse, who is a program analyst here at EPA, so that she can introduce our speakers. Leanne?
Thank you, Jean. Welcome, everyone. I'm going to introduce our presenters for the day. First, Dr. Gina Sarasani is the acting director of EPA's Conflict Prevention and Resolution Center, the CPRC. She works closely with the Superfund program, offering convening, advising, coaching, and facilitation services, and she has served for several years as CPRC's training coordinator. In that role, she has developed multiple new trainings, delivered training to EPA staff and managers across the country, and coordinated CPRC's efforts to provide conflict resolution training throughout EPA. Prior to joining CPRC, Gina was a lecturer and conflict resolution practitioner specializing in community-level conflicts. She earned her doctorate from the School for Conflict Analysis and Resolution at George Mason University, and she has taught undergraduate and graduate courses in environmental conflict resolution practice, and other related topics. Gina has nearly 15 years of experience facilitating dialogues and workshops to address environmental and other conflicts in communities. Also joining us today is Dr. Sarah Cobb. Dr. Cobb has a PhD in communication from UMass Amherst and is the Druce French Kumbi Chair at the School for Conflict Analysis and Resolution, SCAR, at George Mason University, where she was from 2001 to 2009 the dean and director. In her current role as faculty, she teaches and conducts research in the relationship between narrative and conflict. She's also the director for the Center of the Study of Narrative and Conflict Resolution at SCAR, which provides a hub for scholarship on narrative approaches to conflict analysis and resolution. She's also co-editor of the journal Narrative and Conflict, Explorations in Theory and Practice. Dr. Cobb is widely published. Her book, Speaking of Violence, The Politics and Poetics of Narrative and Conflict Resolution from Oxford University Press, lays out the theoretical basis for a narrative lens on both conflict analysis and conflict resolution. This perspective presumes that conflict is a struggle over meaning, anchored in and by the stories we tell. Formerly executive director of the Program on Negotiation at Harvard Law School, she has been a leader in the field of negotiation, conflict resolution studies, conducting narrative research on adaptive governance, serious games, resilient communities, and sustainable systems. Currently, Dr. Cobb is conducting research on conflict prevention in the Arctic. So we welcome both of our esteemed presenters. Dr. Sarasani?
Thank you, Leanne. Welcome, everyone. We're excited to be here today. And we are going to get started, if I can advance my slides. Feels like the first test, and I did it. Okay, so I just want to take a moment to go through our objectives for today. We've got a couple hours, and we're going to try to get you as familiar with a narrative approach as possible and give you a chance to learn some new skills and practice them as much as possible in the webinar setting. We've got some great exercises planned for today, but our objectives are really to make sure that you understand what a narrative is and how what the structure, both the structure and dynamics of narratives are. And then specifically how conflict and more collaborative narratives are developed and what you can do to try to create narratives that support collaboration in the communities where you're working. So what kind of brought us here originally is this narrative framework for community involvement in conflict resolution at Superfund sites that Dr. Cobb and I developed together. And hopefully you all have had a chance to look at that, but that's what really prompted us to try to bring something together where we could make sure that everyone is familiar with this framework and how to use it and how to apply it to your work and community involvement. So we'll go over that, and then finally we will review some tools that will assist you in using a narrative approach at your sites and give you a chance to try out some of those tools. So we'll start with going over some basics of narrative, just to try to get everyone on the same page with what we mean when we talk about narrative and how that is similar to and different from a story. So first of all, narrative is gives us the architecture for our stories, and people organize their experiences using stories. And narrative kind of creates that structure where we can place those. So it does, as any story does, it organizes something that happens, an event, into a sequence of beginning, middle, and end. But narrative is more than just that structure of beginning, middle, and end. And it includes the process of telling stories and the dynamics of that interactive process, where stories are being told, they're being refuted, and they're being elaborated. And elaborated is a term we're going to use a bit in this, so I'll just start off by saying what we mean by that is essentially that those stories are retold by others, and we'll talk about the importance of who is doing the retelling, how those stories are taking hold with groups of people, and the importance of those stories being elaborated by those who are outside your group. So for this group, maybe, you know, folks who are outside EPA, particularly in communities where elaborating those narratives. So we're going to address both the structure and the dynamics of narratives, which are both central to storytelling, and dig into the component parts a little bit. And I also just wanted to point out on that second bullet that one way in which there's an important difference is that there is, with the narrative, there's always a moral point to the story. So we'll talk more about that in just a moment, but for now, just say that there is a good and bad. There's the self and other, and the position of folks within that story. So let's go ahead and move on. We can dig into all of those things. Thank you. All right, so this interactive piece is especially important in building a narrative. And that's one way in which it's very different than one person telling a story. So there's always the storyteller and their role in what's happening, and the others. And just a moment. So with regard to the plot, we just talked a moment ago about the sequence of events and as being a central part of storytelling. In a narrative, the sequence of events externalizes responsibility, and typically for an outcome in which there's a negative outcome that the storyteller is not responsible for. I just attended the Brownfields conference, and this narrative approach and thinking about particularly these through the plot, the characters, and values was really at the forefront of my mind in listening to some of the stories that I heard over the course of a few days, and particularly in what I'm thinking of as gentrification narratives. And now gentrification in itself is a term that disputed. There are different terms that are used. But there were very different narratives coming from developers at the conference and from community members. And so I think that that's so for any of you who've attended that or a similar kind of conference or have heard those kinds of narratives, that might be one thing that you can keep in mind as we talk about that as an example. And I can give you a couple of specific examples as we go through of how that plays out when folks are in that narrative storytelling. So on plot, I think the only other thing that I wanted to say is that the point of it is to ensure that the moral point of the story that I mentioned a few minutes ago is made, and that the other person or the other group is the one responsible for whatever the bad outcomes are. And I just want to say at this moment, Sarah, if there's anything that you where you want to jump in and add anything, feel free.
Thank you.
So with regard to characters, characters in a narrative are typically set up as, and I'm going to use the terms victim and victimizer, even though that that isn't necessarily in as serious a positioning as it may seem. So, but there's, if you think about it, and I thought about this a lot in listening to some of the narratives I heard at this conference, there's, it's sort of a, thinking about it in terms of blame. So the victim is the person who is suffering as a result of what's happened, and the victimizer is responsible for that suffering, whatever that suffering may be. So a core point here is that these are interdependent roles. So the only real threat to the status of the victim is the what we call the destabilization of that of the other. So if the story, the narrative about the victimizer, so if we you go back to the example I brought up just a moment ago, if the story of the developer as victimizer of the community is destabilized in some way, and that might be by telling a somewhat different story that presents a developer in a more positive light, for example, that threatens that those roles as being only victim and victimizer. So from this perspective, the work done in a conflict is to maintain the conflict is to maintain the status of victim for each of those parties. So that's another thing that's important to think about is that this is from the perspective of the storyteller. So each is placing themselves in that victim role and the other is victimizer. Finally, with regard to values, the values in a conflict narrative, and we'll talk more in a bit and have some examples of conflict narratives, but just to introduce that idea, those values are most often black and white. So if you think about it, that's in order to maintain that conflict, there needs to not be any real possibility that there's some good in there, and that you know it's not very complex. So it's very binary, and very clearly one party is good and one party is bad. It's also important to note that values are always anchored in identity and culture, and so the roles that participants are playing manifest those values, and those are anchored in those cultural assumptions and in their identity. So we're going to talk about both a narrative lens, a narrative approach. There are some differences with those, but we're going to kind of use those interchangeably. But I just want you to think about kind of just broadly that when we talk about using a narrative lens or using a narrative approach, what we're really trying to accomplish here with this, in this context is to help you when you're engaged in a conflict or you're witnessing a conflict in the communities where you're working, that you're using these tools that you're going to learn today to think about what are the narratives at play here, how are these narratives creating or contributing to the conflict, and how can understanding this and thinking about the tools that I've learned help me to use that approach to try to develop a more collaborative relationship with the community. And I think that for me, one key idea that I want you to keep in mind as you move forward with that is it's always tougher for us to think about what are our own narratives and how are our own ways of narrating what's happening contributing to this. So to be it's often sometimes easier to start with the other, but to make sure that we also apply that to ourselves. So this can also help us just understand how communities are making meaning of what's happening within their community. And I think that that's always really valuable information for anyone who's working in communities regularly. And it can help us to see how those narratives are not just, they are stories that people are telling, but how those are really, how people are anchored in those stories, and how that meaning making is affecting the dynamics between EPA and the community. Before I go on, I wanted to say this because we didn't say this at the beginning, that if at any point if you have questions, please feel free to share those, and we will, Jean is going to be monitoring those, and if we have a few questions, we'll take a break and answer some of those. So we will have time for questions at the end, but feel free to ask questions along the way if they come up for you. I'm just having trouble advancing sometimes when I go to my larger screen. So let's talk now specifically about collaborative and conflict narratives. And it's kind of shorthand. Really what we're trying to get at here is that there are narratives that are more likely to support or lead to conflict and narratives that are more likely to support or lead to conflict. And so one thing I want to say here about collaborative, because I know we all think about collaboration in different ways, what we don't mean here is that we are looking for everyone to agree. It's much more that if you are able to, and you can see here that we talk about positioning others as being well-intentioned or legitimate, if you're able to kind of see the others positions or the stories that they're telling, the narratives that they're using to make meaning of their situation as well-intentioned and not, you know, and as reflective of the way that they see their situation as legitimate, that you're more likely to be able to get to a place where you can work together. And we've got a couple examples that I think will help to highlight that. I'm just going to move on to those. So the first example is, we understand why people in the community are concerned about their children's health. So key in that, in terms of legitimacy, is we understand. And what I want to point out here is that what this doesn't say is we agree with the conclusion that the community has come to about what's causing the problems with their children's health or any other sort of agreement, but that we understand why in this set of circumstances or why this narrative is legitimate, that you know, we can agree at least that they have a legitimate claim here. And by claim, I mean very much not in a legal sense, just to clarify, I know that we often get into that right away, but I just, when I say claim, I really mean just that the claim that they're making, the position that they're taking in their own narrative. And then the second example is, we appreciate that EPA treats us as a partner in this cleanup. So again, this is a quote, not a direct quote, these are all just examples that we created, but probably things that you've hopefully heard. And so this appreciation, again, is not a community saying that we agree with what EPA has decided for the cleanup, but just that we are seeing EPA as well-intentioned, and it opens up the possibility for collaboration. So moving on to conflict narratives. In a conflict narrative, the storyteller positions the other as in some negative way. And so either as just flat out wrong, as not trustworthy, as incompetent, but you get the idea, all very negative positionings that lead to a continuation of conflict or the development of conflict, rather than opening up the possibility of working collaboratively. And if we look at a couple of examples there, so the first, EPA keeps telling us the water is safe, but they're not listening to us and taking us seriously. So here, EPA is, and I should say too, with all of these, it could be more than one thing. I just selected what I thought was most obvious in that quote. And I think the incompetency is what really comes through. They're not competent to listen to us, to act on the concerns that we're expressing. And so, you know, as you can see, that kind of a narrative is unlikely to lead to working together in a collaborative, constructive way. The second example is this community doesn't want information. They just want to yell at us. So you could infer from this that the community has said that they do want information, and that this narrative reveals that the person, the storyteller, doesn't trust the community in what they're saying. That they may say they want information, but they don't. They really just want to come in and yell at us, and which again would either, you know, develop conflict or if there's already conflict, probably already conflict there, it's only going to build on that and lead to a greater conflict. Okay, so we'll talk for just a moment about the components and dynamics of conflict narratives. So first, as you can see in the components, that the three components of narrative, plot, character, and values, which we've talked about, are not equal, and that's demonstrated by the sizes there, and that the plot and values are in service to the positive and negative positioning of the characters. So the character roles, and that's identified there in speaker legitimacy, are more important, and that the plot and values serve to develop the speaker legitimacy or the character role. So this is important for conflict dynamics because we often talk about, you know, that we need to discuss the facts and we need to come to agreement on the facts. And so what this gets us to kind of think about is that it's often not about the facts, but about how we're positioning ourselves, how we're positioning the others in our narratives, and where responsibility lies. And you can see in the dynamics piece of this, this, you know, his fault, her fault, their fault. But I think that, you know, even if you think sort of outside of your work experiences, when you're telling these stories and when we're in conflict, I was listening actually for this at this conference too, and a couple of the presentations that I went to, and you know, you just really don't hear that, and you really don't hear anyone talking about their own responsibility in it. It's always the other, and so those are the dynamics that develop a conflict narrative. So I'll just say quickly, just to use this slide to give you a sense of how these dynamics operate. Particularly, this was developed to think about the dynamics between EPA and communities. And so what you can probably, hopefully, very easily see from this model, if we developed it in a way that it's easy to interpret, is that these are influencing one another. So the double arrow shows that so EPA develops a narrative about the community, EPA develops a narrative about itself, and the community does the same, narrative about itself, narrative about EPA. And those are fluid, and those influence each other. So the thing that I think is important to take from this is that as those change, the others change as well. So that this is, we're not stuck there, and that, you know, this kind of leads us to the tools that we'll be talking about in just a little bit, that we can use those to try to influence those narratives and create change that can help to develop a more collaborative relationship. So the role of power in the narrative context, I talked just a moment ago about the elaboration of a narrative, and I just want to say here that that elaboration is what creates power in a narrative context. So that ability to get the story to take hold. And so if, you know, if we talk about as EPA, if you all as community involvement coordinators are talking about what a great job you're doing in a community, that's one thing. That's fine. That's expected, maybe. But if the community is talking about what a great job you're doing, that there's, you know, there's an elaboration of that narrative that's very different. And I think that's a simple example, but it can kind of give you a sense of what we mean when we talk about elaboration. And so, again, all of this is dynamic. And so just to remember that, you know, once, so if that were to happen, we might say, well, you know, EPA's really got power here. They've got, you know, it's, they're not just saying that they're doing a great job. The community is saying they're doing a great job. And that could change tomorrow, so or in 10 minutes. So it's not static. And the last thing I'll say before I turn it over to Sarah is that it's important also to think about marginalized and dominant narratives so that not all narratives, and that's sort of why we introduced kind of the concept of power in a narrative context first. And we want you to think about how who's telling the stories and, you know, where they are in kind of a in a power structure. And so marginalized narratives tend to be told by vulnerable populations. Many of you work with such populations. And they might challenge the dominant narratives, which are the ones that are that have power, that are being circulated, that are being elaborated, and might be crowding out those marginalized narratives. So, but I think just going back to the concept of power is to remember that while it may be more difficult for a vulnerable population to get their narrative out there, that it's not necessarily dominant and marginalized, might not be who you expect they would be in a narrative context. And again, that it's all dynamic. Right.
So, hi, this is Sarah Cobb speaking, and I want to thank Gina for setting us up, I think, to understand a little bit better how we might actually go about moving from these conflict narratives, which are, once entrenched, we know, so difficult to evolve. And that's what we're really talking about today, is kind of these intractable conflict narratives. So moving forward to the next slide, my job here is to talk about, we want to first think about what narratives create or keep us in conflict, in a destructive conflict, and which ones support our constructive engagement.
So I think this is, yeah, so we're going to do the video now. And so, Jean, I need to adjust the volume, is that right?
And the purpose of this video is just to take a look at, just the purpose of the video is just to take a look at dynamics real time. You know, I know we've all lived through this, but let's look at it together and see what it looks like.
Okay, so we're going to play just a few videos for the audience right now. I'll remind my presenters there in the conference room, you'll want to be sure to mute your telephone line there in the room just while the videos are playing. And then you'll want to turn the computer volume back on for those of you there again in the conference room with the presenters. For the rest of you who are just viewing this as a participant, the audio for the sound is going, or for the movie, is going to play back online, but we have closed captioned it. So I'm going to hit the play button here, and you'll be able to listen as well as read the captionings as the video plays back.
Thank you, Jim. I just wanted to, my gosh, we've got a lot of people here. Thank you, Jim. I just wanted to, my gosh, we've got a lot of people here. Thank you all for coming out. I spent a lot of my time in Washington, and the thing that I would tell you that's different about Washington and here is here you applauded for all the politicians. I thought that was pretty good. Nobody gets applauded in Washington at all. I want to bring you greetings from Administrator Pruitt. As many of you know, Administrator Pruitt made the Westlake landfill a top priority relative to his administration. He's talked about it on numerous interviews. He's talked about it with the president, and he is serious about getting it cleaned up. A couple things that occurred relative to our task force. One was The administrator established a list of special emphasis projects or special emphasis sites. One of those special emphasis sites, out of 21 sites of the 1,344 sites that we have today in this country, one of the 21 was the Westlake. The purpose of that list is to say he wants everyone to know that those 21 sites today are the ones that are getting his emphasis. Doesn't mean the rest of the sites aren't getting emphasis, but these are getting his. And in particular, Westlake has gotten a lot of his emphasis. He has charged all of us with getting to a solution and to show you that he's not standing behind anyone else, but standing out there in front, he retained authority to approve all remedies above $50 million in cost. Well, obviously, this one is above $50 million in cost, and so it falls squarely on him.
Okay, we should have reached the end of that video. Sarah, did you want to share anything before we move on to the next one?
No, we can go ahead and move on to the next one.
Okay, we'll be playing our next video. Again, audio will be online, but you can also follow along with the closed captioning on the screen.
You taking notes? Good. My name is Dawn Chapman, co-founder of Just Mindset Radio. That it's okay for you to get cancer. Which one of you wants to get cancer? They're talking about an unacceptable risk. Which one of you wants to get cancer? Which one? Nobody. Nobody. How many of you have been hurt by this waste in St. Louis? I don't care where it's at or know somebody. Of the 1,000-plus people in this room, does anybody here know anybody that's been hurt by this waste? That is why as much of this waste that can be removed needs to be removed. Now, I understand there's this thing called the muffin top. Can we please find a new name for that? We're going to brainstorm about that. And I understand that mound. And I understand that that is deep. But there is no reason why Alternative 7 should not be used across all other areas of this site. Alternatives at this site, it is very important that you understand we're raising our kids here. We are investing in our community. We are not trying to block this community. We want this community to grow. And you're asking us to let this community grow and raise our kids in a community where you're not willing to go as deep as you can. Again, I get the amount. I totally get it. I understand. But the rest of this site deserves more than 16 feet. Last but not least, get my friends in Spanish Village the hell out of here. Get the hell out of here. You can hear the whole country. And it's time to let these people go. Let them start over. They don't want much. They just want out. That's it. Thank you very much.
Wanted to mention that, and I don't know who all we've got with us, so there may even be someone who's worked at the site, but that was from a public meeting at the Westlake Landfill site in Region 7. And the first speaker was Cal Kelly, who was at the time the assistant administrator. For, no. Okay, yes. So so it's senior advisor in Superfund and then the Superfund task force, yes. I think he references the task force in that those remarks. And then the second speaker is Dawn Chapman, who is I think one of the co-founders and co-chairs, I'm not sure what their titles are, of the community group Just Moms St. Louis. And this site, for those who don't know, it's actually a pretty well-known site, is near St. Louis. And just one final note, this is a video on YouTube. That's where I found it. So I was not at this meeting, did not take the video. And now we're just going to talk for a few minutes about the examples of the narratives that were evident in these videos and, you know, how they kind of fit into this thinking about what creates conflict and what creates collaboration. So I'll turn it back over to you for a moment, Sarah, if you want to start us off with a couple comments. And then after we do this, we're going to actually do a role play based on this interaction. We'll be doing a few role plays throughout the rest of the webinar today based on this interaction.
Well, this is Sarah, and I would say that for all of us, you know, we are all experts in narrative, so you don't have to have a PhD in anything to feel the difference between these two stories, you know. And in the first story, the first video clip, I imagined myself a member of the audience wondering how it felt to hear the administrator talk about how important the site was to the administrator Pruitt. And on one hand, I felt like it was his way to try to legitimize the community, right? And they must have, he was trying to convey they are really important to at the highest level in EPA. And I think that's one thing to have somebody report, look, Administrator Pruitt really likes you, he really values you, he really cares for you. But I felt listening to it like it was an attempt to avoid in some way the heat directly to him from the community. So now we have three people in there. We have three characters in the story now. We've got the others that he's speaking to. We have himself as the speaker, and we have Administrator Pruitt there. And he's basically looking at Administrator Pruitt and saying, look, you know, he really cares. But he didn't say, I care, you know. And that was really interesting. And I wondered how the community would respond. I wondered whether there would be, it would ease their minds to hear that Administrator Pruitt cared, or whether there were some other additional ways that he could have conveyed that concern and care. Relative to, Gina, did you have any thoughts on that?
No, I think that sums it up well. Why don't we go ahead and move on.
I always have to, I'm sitting in the EPA office, right, always worried to be too critical of EPA. So forgive my directness on all this. The other side of the coin, if we listen to the mom, you know, from who's representing the activist group, you know, she's clearly telling a story that a lot of people have elaborated back channel. So clapping and uproar and, you know, yes, and all the affirmation she's getting from the audience, that's not the first time they're hearing this story. So one of the interesting things to point out is that of these clips is that particularly around affirmation, but also, you know, non-affirmation, you find people doing that in public, and it requires them to have done it in private a lot. So what I see here is sort of an archaeologist looking as a sort of a narrative geologist, right, looking down the sedimentary layers. I can see this has been happening for a long time. These stories have been under development. I would also say that the story the activist mom is telling, from my view, is very, very binary in the way in which Gina was just describing. You have good guys and bad guys, you know, right and wrong. Things are black and white, and there is no room for gray. And I believe that, as I understand this, I don't know anything about the site. I'm just listening to the narrative. So this, what we see here is sort of characterization of the sort of narrative features that Gina has laid out. Did you have any thoughts, Gina?
Yeah, I think the only thing that I heard so Dawn Chapman is the name of the activist who is speaking, and I think the only thing I heard in what she said, and it was really more implied than spoken directly, but she did say something at one point about, you know, the question here is how much of the waste they'll remove, how far down they'll go, and she did say something at one point about that kind of implied, I know you're trying to do, you know, your best and go, but you really need to do better. You know, what you think is the best is really not good enough for our community. But there was just a little bit of acknowledgement there that I picked up at least that that she thought that they were trying. And I think it was completely overpowered by everything else. But I don't know if that was a little bit of a nod to anyone or, you know, or maybe I read too much into it.
I'm looking at the comments online here, and I'm agreeing with, you know, Jim, I believe Jim Smith, who's talked about, you know, basically that the administrator was trying to communicate to the community that, EPA is paying attention, and also that EPA has good intentions. Now, I just want to make a comment on that. It's very difficult to be a speaker in a conflict narrative where you have to affirm your own good intentions. You know, it's very hard. If Gina says, Sarah prepared well for this, Sarah took time, we spent hours preparing this thing, I'm going to feel totally legitimized by her in front of all of you. But if I have to tell you, I really did spend time, folks, I promise you I spent time preparing, there's a way in which the speaker themselves never quite is able to legitimize themselves the way a third party or another person can. So I believe the good intentions are that is his effort, but I'm not sure how it lands with the community there. Good comments. Thank you. So now we're going to engage in a short role play based, as I said, on this interaction that we just saw a moment ago. And in this first role play, the situation is that there's a conversation that's going to happen after this meeting, and the two characters in the conversation will be a fictional EPA community involvement coordinator who's following up with Don Chapman, named Pat Johnson, and then Don Chapman, the community activist. And so we'll just go through this conversation, and then we'll be, so those boxes, we actually want you to be, it's great that you use them for the response to the video, and so we can go back and look at those responses too, but we also want you to use those boxes to be listening during the role play and respond to what you're hearing in our conversation that supports collaboration or conflict and respond there.
Can I make a comment first?
Sure. Mm-hmm. I just want to comment to Helen. Helen's comment here I think is so important. She's arguing or positing the importance of getting specific rather than general, and I think that's going to be really valuable later and later on in our seminar when we talk about increasing the complexity of narratives. So just hold that thought, Helen. Thank you so much for contributing that. So you want me to go?
You start.
Okay. Yes. So I am Pat. This is Sarah. I'm Pat. So thanks so much, Don, for agreeing to talk with me. I know that you'd like to see a different cleanup decision, and it's obvious, really obvious, that you've had a lot of support from the community at the meeting.
Yeah, it's not just a different decision that we want. We want EPA to select the alternative that makes us as safe as possible. I mean, wouldn't you want that if it were your community? We don't want anyone else to die.
Well, of course, we don't want anybody to die either. And the site is a top priority, as I've mentioned. But the alternative was selected based on the risk presented to the community. And this option removes enough of the radioactive waste to reduce the risk to acceptable levels.
Acceptable to whom? I mean, again, would you live here? It's easy to say it's acceptable when your children aren't at risk.
Well, Dawn, I can tell that you care deeply about your community. And given all this, the community has been through, it makes sense that you're fearful and you don't trust a federal agency to fix this problem.
Of course I don't. The federal government's responsible for creating the waste and putting it in the landfill in the first place.
Well, would you be willing to imagine for a moment that we're at the end of this cleanup, you know, let's say some years from now? Well, what would your community look like in your view? What would some characteristics of it be?
Well, it would be clean. I mean, people would be healthy. People would be healthy. We wouldn't have to worry about everyone we know getting cancer.
So that would be, you know, markers of good positive change, right? Would be health,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Any other markers?
Well, I think we'd. I mean, another marker would be that the waste has been cleaned up. So that would be done. That's what I want to see in the future. That yes, yeah, so we're at the end of the cleanup. They've removed. I mean, we'd like to see, you know, as I said, alternative 7. We'd like to see more of the waste removed. But yeah, people aren't worrying about that anymore. That worry takes a toll too.
Well, that's very interesting. So it would also be. Increased peace of mind.
Yes.
Less focus on all of this.
Yes.
Very
peace of mind.
Very interesting.
Okay. Okay. So we'll stop there, and let's just give everyone a couple minutes to type into the boxes what you heard in that conversation that supported collaboration and what you heard that supported conflict.
And as you're typing, you'll be able to read responses that the audience has shared in. If you happen to see a response that's been entered by another participant, you can actually agree with their response. So if you see something that you also feel similarly or that you think is a correct answer, hover your cursor over that person's entry. You should see a little plus one to the right of their answer. You can click that plus one and vote to agree with their particular response. So you can chime in with your own answers or agree with others who have answered before you.
Because we want to stay on track for time, we'll take maybe another 30 seconds or so to take answers.
And thanks to those voting, it looks like we're starting to see some popular responses sort of settle out here. Okay, Gina, Sarah, do you want to read through some of the responses that you're seeing?
Sure. So we've got one that says, a focus on what they agree on rather than what they don't, reduced risk versus a specific cleanup option. So, and I should clarify that this is in the box, what did you hear that supported collaboration? Another response is asking additional questions and repeating what the community person said. So I think that's a reference to the role play that we just did where Sarah confirmed what she heard from me. Focusing on the future moves the narrative to a positive place. So the question she asked about what I could imagine it looking like in the future, what the community would be. Just read one more from this. EPA officials seem to imply that EPA found the site was important. Oh, okay, so this is from the video and was paying attention. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Confirmed the legitimacy of the community and by saying that. And then in the box, what did you hear that supported conflict? We've touched on a couple of these. Let's see. Community activists seems to have no room for any compromise, perpetuating the conflict. So that kind of gets to what Sarah, I think, said earlier about the black and white mm-hmm. presentation.
Extreme language.
Yes, extreme language. When Pat says, we will be reducing risk, and Don says, we want all of the waste removed, they are talking past each other and not agreeing on an endpoint. True. And then community leader made it sound like EPA was not competent, which is, yes, contributing to conflict. Okay, great. So we want to move on to a couple more concepts in this period, but we're going to keep coming back to this role play will be the one that we'll do a few more times in different contexts. So you'll get another chance to kind of see how this plays out.
You know, you can see it and know it when you see it, what contributes to conflict. We're pretty good at that. And even there was a lot of good ideas about some good ideas about how to support conflict resolution. But I want to offer you a theory of that would be a foundation for the tools that we're going to share with you today. And that is a theory that helps us move towards more collaborative, more positive, or what I've called better stories, right? And they're really, it's simple, very simple. You want to increase the complexity of a narrative, and that's your main goal. And you can do it across three dimensions. You can increase the complexity of the plot, or the second is the character roles, or the third is the themes or value frameworks. So those are the three component parts of a narrative structure, and if you're going to increase the complexity of it, you do it in any one of those three. But as the diagram earlier showed, these are all interconnected. So if you increase the complexity of the plot, you're going to shift the character roles and the themes and, you know, et cetera. So all of these are interrelated. Now, what do we mean by, you know, better stories? What does it mean to increase the complexity? So if we look at the next slide, well, you've got to tell more complicated plots. And this has to do with even adding events to a line. So you'll find people saying, you know, everything was fine, and then suddenly we were polluted, and now EPA is here telling us that they're not going to address our issues, or they're not going to address them thoroughly. Well, there's a lot of things that happened in those spaces and those historical time frames that don't get mentioned. So one of the ways to increase the complexity of the plot is to increase the kind of events that are on a plot history line. And though all of that is aimed at ensuring that you get storylines or story trajectories where the characters are being framed as, you know, imperfect, and that's often going to de-escalate the conflict. At the second level, relative to the characters, you want to make sure that the story has legitimacy for all the parties, and this may involve showcasing their positive traits, because one of the ways you increase the legitimacy of folks is to frame them as having good traits. You know, I would rather be, I'd love it if I get framed as being smart, right, by Gina, for instance, or if one of the community members had stood up and told the administrator there in the video, sir, I really think your coming here to our site is a sign of your care and concern. That would have been an example of that kind of positive affirmation. Or you can affirm through positive intention, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit. That's going to be called positive connotation. You can increase the complexity by increasing the value, by increasing the complexity of the value system, so things are not black and white. And we're going to talk again about how to do that. And basically, we've got to make sure that things are interactively produced. In other words, I can't simply tell an audience as an EPA administrator what is going to happen. I have to ensure that I'm in an actual conversation with people, right? And so making sure that these stories are interactively produced over time is really critical. So we know this, just to summarize here, I'm arguing that conflict resolution can happen through increasing the complexity of the story, and we've got some frameworks. We're going to have three that we're going to go over with you to give you specific tools. Thanks, Sarah. So because we want to make sure that you have as much time as possible to really engage with these, I'm going to speed up just a little bit my overview of the narrative framework for Superfund sites. Again, hopefully you all have had a chance to take a look at it or are at least familiar with it. There's a photo of the front page of the guide on this slide. And if you, for some reason, haven't and you need a copy, feel free to get in touch with me after this webinar and I can get one to you. So I just want to give you a sense of why we put it together, what's in it, how you might use it. And really, you know, as you might have put together, I encountered Sarah's work when I was a doctoral student at George Mason School for Conflict Analysis and Resolution, and then working in EPA in the Conflict Prevention and Resolution Center, I thought, I really think this work could be beneficial in how we're thinking about conflicts here, and most of my work has been with Superfund, and I thought it would be really valuable to try to bring some of this to Superfund community involvement to strengthen, or to, at least to give community involvement coordinators and others who work at Superfund sites
other tools that they can use to try to prevent and resolve conflict. So that's how it emerged, and we wanted to make it, you know, as practical as possible to explain what this narrative approach is. We used a case study example and provided tools to which are the ones that we'll go over today as well, to give folks some new skills for addressing conflicts at sites. So you can see on the slide that it's divided into these four parts. So we kind of do the intro to what narratives are, introduce the tools, use this case study, and apply the tools and the narrative approach to this case study from Camp Minden in Region 6, which is a site where CPRC provided assistance twice, actually. And then finally, in part four, we provide some best practices for using these narrative tools at Superfund sites. And so I think most of these things I actually talked about on the first slide. Probably what's key here is there's, to the greatest extent possible, we try in this guide to provide some help with how you would implement this, so what this would look like in practice if you were to use these tools in your Superfund community involvement work, and provide some examples and actually even some scripts of, like, if you were doing an interview, here's what you might ask. If you're, you know, engaged in a conversation at a public meeting or a conversation, you know, doing an open house or something, here are some questions you might ask. So we tried to make it as practical as possible. And so finally, how you can apply this to your work is it can help you. It's kind of things I talked about earlier with regard to the goals of this webinar, that it can help you to identify the narrative dynamics at your Superfund site, help you assess how those narratives are contributing to either conflict or collaboration, and provide some tools for how you can begin to transform those conflict narratives, to better promote collaboration and build trust with communities. So again, if anyone is interested, you know, even if you have the guide, if you have questions, you can feel free to contact me. If you would like to, or if you don't have it and you would like to have a copy, please let me know. Okay, now I'm going to turn it back over to Sarah to talk about narrative tools and the skills that we've been talking about.
So here's where we really have, we're going to try to give you three concrete tools for that you can use in any setting that would support the evolution of narrative, that would increase its complexity. These are tools that increase complexity and promote better formed stories. So the three are positive connotations, circular questions, and externalizations. And again, you can use these in private interviews. You can use them in public settings. Any conversation that you're in, you know, group meetings of any kind. So they're both at, in fact, you can even use them in the documents you're writing, because one of the respondents online mentioned the design of narrative and documents. So I think that's also a good point to make. So let's start with positive connotation. It's a wonderful tool. This is probably the golden bullet for conflict resolution from a narrative lens. And it's very simple. It's about the attribution of positive intention. So this is a tool for building trust. And it involves assigning, framing people as intending to do well. Not people having good traits. Somebody can be smart, and that's not positive intention. Positive intention is the effort that you note that somebody else is trying to do something good. So these are positive explanations, their responses to negative stories, and they help create an environment of mutual trust. So, for instance, I have a two daughters, well, I have multiple daughters, but two of them are in a giant conflict in my family, and this is a total secret amongst 85 of you, right? So don't tell anybody. One of my daughters is a climate scientist, and the other is a high-up executive at a major oil company. And they have been at each other's throats recently, both of them texting me and saying, can you believe what she said? You know, and then I hear from the next one, I couldn't believe, I talked to her and she refuses to, blah, 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 blah. And I'm trying to wade into this conflict, a family conflict, in an effort to positively connote each one. So I positively connote the oil executive as, look, this is a person that has put herself on the inside of a very large industry that needs a lot of change and support to build that change, to become a force for good on the planet. And we either want people we love and care about in those places. We'd like to have that because that's the best chance we have of bringing about good change. And relative to the climate scientists, I've tried to argue to the other one, well, you know, in terms of her intentions, she's trying to support the advance of our social policy, our policies, political politics and policies to support climate change, to advance our responses to climate change. Anyway, so far, they're helping, but they haven't been thoroughly elaborated yet. So I would argue that I've got a little bit of ways to go in this, but I'm making a start. At least those are the texts I sent yesterday. So how do these work for you, right? Now, we're not just talking about your family conflicts, although these will work for you. Well, they help people reframe their view of others. Now, you can't do a positive connotation and say, oh, I understand that the administrator was trying to signal that EPA Central is interested in you folks. You have to make that attribution, make that description, make that positive connotation, and then somebody else has to say on the other side of that, oh, I see that, or oh, I agree with that, or that was really nice. They have to pick it up some way. It has to be elaborated or it's not going to stick. So this alters the narrative dynamics, and it interrupts these cycles of blame and polarization. It reduces polarization and increases engagement because one of the secret sauces for narrative change is legitimacy. People are in struggle with each other in part because they're framed as illegitimate by their others. So if you can interrupt or alter those frames where people have been delegitimized, there's more space for conversation, for negotiation, for addressing real problems. Because it's not just about position, it's about the issues then. Do we have a role play, I think? Yes, I think we have a role play now.
So we're going to pick up this conversation between Pat and Dawn for a second role play, and you will have an opportunity to weigh in on this one as well. I don't know, is there anything that you need to say, Jean, about that?
No, I'll just remind the audience that those windows will appear in the bottom left where they can type in their own responses. And if they agree with something that someone else has entered, just hover your cursor over that response and hit the plus one to vote for it.
Great, thank you. Okay, we'll jump right in.
So, Dawn, thanks for taking the time to talk with me about the agenda for the next CAG meeting. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. I want to be sure that you're prepared to answer our questions. And when we come to these meetings and we don't get answers, it feels like a waste of our time. At past meetings, it kind of seems like EPA is stalling.
Well, that's fair. I know we haven't always been able to provide answers on the spot, and I just want to express that we're really grateful to you and the other community members for showing up to these meetings and for continuing to work with us. I know you've got kids, and I'm sure it is easy to be away from your family in the evening, and really, I want to thank you for your commitment.
Well, thanks for saying that. I appreciate it. I do it for my kids. That's why I'm doing this work. And I'll keep fighting for them until they have a clean, healthy place to live. You know how frustrated I am with EPA, but I do know that you also have to give up time with your family to come to these meetings, and I do appreciate that.
Wow, thank you for acknowledging that. Okay, let's talk about the agenda and what kind of information we'd be ready to provide.
Okay, so that's the end of our role play. So if you'd like to weigh in on what parts of the interaction demonstrated positive connotations, please do so now. So what did you hear in that interaction where we assigned positive intent to one another? So we've had one person weigh in. The community member notes that EPA also has to give up time with their family. Yes, great. What else did you hear? Saying thank you to the communities we serve is so important. Yes, that's for sure. And what was the third one? Community member notes that EPA, oh, yeah, we said that one. Okay, sorry. Oh, they interrupted blaming by thanking and recognizing each other's sacrifices. Excellent. And EPA empathized with the community member, showing that EPA really values their time.
Yeah, all of these are good.
Got some votes on some of them. We'll give it maybe another 20, 30 seconds or so and see if anyone else has got anything that they want to weigh in with. Down here.
Yeah, there's a, one of them mentions that there's a sort of a mutual recognition of sacrifices, right? And that's interesting because a sacrifice is I'm going to give up something in order to try to do something else. So there's a recognition of the commitment that both parties have in that statement. So that's good. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I'm reading and saying yes, yes.
Yeah, and
that's right.
You know, that it allowed them to going through that interaction and making those positive connotations allowed them to move to that next step of talking about the agenda.
Yeah, one could almost say that positive connotation does the relational work, right? And the relational work has to be done before any of the concrete agenda or any of the specifics. You can get to those because you can't get to the specifics when the relations are extremely contested and polarized.
Great. Well, I think that folks have the idea here. Yeah, this is a good point, too. I just want to note this. A lot of gratitude was expressed specific examples and not just a simple thank you.
Yeah.
So they really noted, I appreciate that you give up your time to come here, rather than just saying, you know, thanks for being here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very nice.
Great. Okay, well, we're going to go ahead and move on to the next tool.
So I want to talk for a little bit. There's a circular questions is one of the tools we're going to share with you. But prior to getting into the nitty-gritty of circular questions, I just want to make a general comment on questions. They are your friend for the evolution of narrative because they are basically like crowbars. You know, you can open what is basically something that's nailed shut that you want to try to support the evolution of through a question. So there are really four kinds of questions generally that we're breaking down here for you. And there are two that you don't want and two that you do. The ones you don't want are linear questions that basically call for causal explanation. Why do you think this happened? Or what's been happening here? Both of those questions are invitations to the conflict narrative to come out and play. So don't ask a linear question if you can help it. The second kind you don't want is the strategic questions, and these are the leading questions, you know, like you've got kind of lawyers do where you say, you know, don't you think, and then whatever it is afterwards, you're trying to get the person to say that, you know, don't you think this was the wrong thing to do? You want somebody to agree with you. So as an intervener and basically an EPA community, you know, engagement person is in fact an intervener. You're there not only to collect information but engaging and supporting the evolution of the community around a particular issue. So at that level, you're intervening. So these strategic questions are not your friend. However, reflective questions are fabulous, and they enable you to ask questions that dig down, help people dig down to talk about actions, the meaning, what's behind actions, as perceptions, people's opinions, their views of themselves, their understandings of the other. All of those reflections open the space for conversations to be on in different tracks than it has been. And that's what you want to try to do, is support this increased complexity. And the one that I'm going to talk about next, finally, is the circular question. This might be something you hadn't heard of. These are questions that basically call for comparisons between people or between time. And they open up what we would call the discursive field. I mean, that's just a fancy way of saying they give you more terminology to import into your conversations with other people. So if the conversations are only about dogs and cats, you don't want to ask questions about dogs and cats. You want to ask questions about birds and giraffes or something. So that opens up these new kinds of, those are silly examples, but it kind of opens up a new way of thinking about new possibilities for conversation. So can I have the next one? So with that as a little bit of background, let me describe a circular question to you. These are questions which, again, use comparisons as a way to help people develop understanding for each other. And they ask the speaker, the question asks the speaker to reflect on what's explicit and implicit in terms of their understanding of other people and the past and the future. And they also enable you, because you're basically acting as a third party in this moment, to introduce new dimensions, you know. Into the conversation. So let me give you an example. It would have been rather interesting for the EPA administrator to stand up there, I'm just inventing this now, and say, okay, I'm here tonight. Thank you so much for coming. I think we have some very difficult conversations to have. And one of the things I wanted to start off with is sort of recognizing the EPA is kind of, we're at some level, we're a scientific organization. We have to obey laws, and it makes us kind of an obsessive organization. You know, we care about details. And, you know, obsessive people and obsessive organizations are sometimes sort of difficult to build, get along with, and it's difficult to engage them. But I wondered if there are any people in the audience that are obsessive. And I just wondered, you know, how does the audience understand itself? Do you know of obsessive people? Is there anybody here that would describe themselves as obsessive over all of this? We could have had a big community conversation, and after some hilarity and maybe even some people getting upset, people would have framed themselves as, yes, I'm obsessive. I'm obsessed with these details. I'm obsessed with my child's health. But it would have put the conversation on a different footing through this notion of obsessive. So because that wasn't a word that either the community or the EPA had been using up to that point, it might be just a simple example. So. Now, let me talk. Oh, I think we're going to do a role play now, right?
Yes, we are. So we want to kind of give you an opportunity to see this in action. And we know that we haven't given you a lot of information so far about circular questions, so that you're going to get an opportunity to look at some questions that you'll be hearing and decide whether you think they are circular or not. And then we'll be referring back to this as we move through the rest of the content and give you more information about what circular questions are. So this is just to kind of give you upfront in action, here's what this looks like. And I'd like to begin.
Okay, so Dawn, thanks for taking the time for a check-in with me. That last meeting was a rough one. No, I'm in the wrong form. I'm on the wrong one. Dawn, thanks for taking a time for a check-in with me. The last meeting was a rough one. How do you think it went?
People are definitely upset, as I'm sure you could figure out, and we're really worried that the remedy is not going to make us safe.
Well, I definitely heard those concerns. And who in the community do you think is most worried about the remedy?
I mean, that's hard to say. But do you know Michael, who lives near the site? His wife has cancer, and he's a wreck right now. He's worried about his wife. He's also worried that he or his kids will get sick. He's definitely one of the most concerned people I know.
I do know him, and yes, he certainly is going through a difficult time. What do you think worries him about the cleanup?
I think he's worried that it doesn't remove enough waste and that maybe it'll help for a while, but that as long as there's radioactive material in that landfill, we're still at risk. And I think he's concerned about how the waste is going to be removed, how that'll be transported. Wouldn't you be worried if you were in his shoes?
I can see why he's concerned, and that's really helpful to know. I'll make a note of it to bring up with the team when we plan for the next meeting. And by comparison, who do you think is the least worried about the remedy?
I don't know. Everyone's worried, but maybe Lynn. She's only come to a few meetings, and I think among the people I know, she seems to be the least worried about this for some reason.
And what do you think her view of the cleanup is?
I think she agrees with EPA's risk assessment, so she thinks the remedy is sufficient to make us safe. I don't agree with her, as you know.
Yes, I know. And why do you think she agrees with our risk assessment?
I assume it's because she trusts EPA, and maybe she just wants to feel safe. I'm really not sure.
Okay.
All right. So it looks like folks have started weighing in on the questions.
Got it. Great.
So so far we've got a few folks saying, who in the community do you think is most worried about the remedy is a circular question. And I would agree with
you. And they're correct.
What do you think worries him about the cleanup? We've got many votes coming in for that one as a circular question. And again, you are right. Who do you think is least worried about the remedy? We've got several votes for that as a circular question.
That's correct.
It looks like a few more votes coming in for what do you think her view of the cleanup is?
That's correct.
And we've also got a few votes for why do you think she agrees with our risk assessment? Only four votes on that one. yeah, I think, and well, you'll see as we move forward why I think that is a circular question. Let's see, do we have any others that I missed? Okay, it looks like the voting has slowed down. So yeah, I think even given the little bit of information that we've given you so far about circular questions, it looks like you're catching on to what they are, and of course we try to make them as evident as possible in the role play. But let's move on now and talk a little bit more about what circular questions look like and how to form them. So
again, this is a particularly bright audience, so you've got the answers you were giving, I think, were correct. So now we're going to back up and talk more particularly about two different kinds of circular questions, now that you seem to get the gist of the sort of thing you're looking for. There are two kinds. There are temporal circular questions and relational circular questions. The temporal ones call for a comparison between time one and time two. So you might ask, for instance, if we were to look 10 years from now, and notice for the most part the beginning of a temporal circular question is hypothetical. If we were to be 10 years in the future, right? Or if we were to look back in the last 5 years, then the next phrase it calls for the comparison. What would you see as a thread that has been maintained from now, from 5 years ago to today? So how would you compare what's been happening, what happened 5 years ago, to what's been happening today? Or what would you like to see 10 years in the future? If I were to magically press a button and we were to be in the future 10 years from now, what might we see in your community that you would want to see? What sort of characteristics would your community have? Both of those are temporal questions that call for comparison. Relational questions are comparisons between people. So if I were to ask the people sitting in the room, and there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of us in here, if I were to ask which of them are the most surprised by circular questions, I'm asked Gina because she knows them. Who of the 6 people is the most surprised about circular questions? And now you can't see me, but they're all looking at me now, wondering, what's Gina going to say, right? So relational comparisons are fabulous because it's like public gossip, right? You can do it in a private interview. You could ask somebody, okay, you've been a leader in a community for 10 years. Who in the community do you think I should speak to next? Because it's basically asking a question to get the perspective on the community from the person you're speaking with, and share that with you. So that's a circular question. You could also say in a public meeting to, let's say, this activist that was speaking there in the video, the comment back from the EPA after she sits down is, wow, you know, I think she's really articulate. And clearly, there have been many of you that have been following this closely and understand the issues. So I want to ask you, Madam Activist, Madam, was it Dawn, right? Mm-hmm. I want to ask you, Dawn, who in the community are you most concerned needs to be most better informed? Now, that's a different conversation because now she's telling me not just what her view is, but she's telling me about other people in the community that she thinks need to be more involved. So, again, it shifts the footing of the conversation. So those are the 2 kinds of circular questions. Let me do a little bit of description now about how they help you. Basically, conflicts that are underway, and believe, you know this better even than I do, that by the time you show up at a site working with a community, the conflict is well underway. And because of that, it's been underway for a while, the terms and conditions of the conversation, the way they evolve, what people count as important, what the words they use, how they frame the problem, where they understand it came from, that's all set. That's all discursively put in concrete by the time you showed up. So circular questions help you disrupt. They disobey these sort of grid lines along which the conversation has been working, and they enable you to open it up a little bit by introducing some new values, new terminology, maybe some different plot events, et cetera. And they generate what's called relational knowledge, particularly for the relational conversations, for the relational questions. So one of the things I wanted to stress with this, and it's not so much in the slide, but I wanted to make this comment, is that in order to get a better story, to help the better story evolve, you want to, as I mentioned, increase the complexity. And one of the ways you do that is allowing people to reflect on their own understandings and what they're based on and how they see others, et cetera. So these circular questions give us, that's why it's called relational knowledge about how other people are seeing things, which are just super, super duper, very powerful and very interesting. Let me talk now about some temporal comparisons. These are the second kind of circular questions, where you can introduce a new plot or, you know, narrative component, and you can allow communities to envision themselves either comparing the past to the present or comparing the present to the future. This generates some new differences. Now, I've only got just a few minutes more, so I wanted to not take too much time here, but I wanted to talk about differences for 1 second. Mm-hmm. In a conflict, the differences, in other words, the way in which people are understanding right from wrong or good from bad or safety from danger, all of that is already set. So one of the things that these questions do is enable you as an intervener, as the person provoking conversations, it enables you to insert new terminology, new frameworks, new dimensions of the conflict. So if, in fact, the conflict is rigidly organized around a given set of dimensions or a given set of words, you can open it up by these temporal and relational questions. So they're just, you know, great. For example, you can see here that we might have in the present, you know, people who would be discussing if you ask questions that are circular in nature from the temporal typology. You're asking them for a comparison of the present, which where things are dangerous and there's no opportunities for safety or for change. And then you ask them to compare that with 10 years from now. And you might be able to support their discussions about resilience, about empowerment, and those terms, which you hope to be able to get them to enumerate and state, provide new dimensions for the conflict. So those, again, they're easy to ask, and they're very, very powerful questions. Now, the relational comparisons are interesting. You can call for, the question can call for a comparison on any term that you want to make. You don't want to put them on a, you don't want to ask for a comparison based on something that would be delegitimizing, like who do you think has gained the most weight in the last 5 years, right? People to answer that question would have to be kind of horrified. But in your context, you'd be asking about, you know, who maybe is more anxious, or which are the groups that seem to be most or least likely to participate. So these help you, develop with the community descriptions or dimensions of difference that can open up new lines of consideration. So you can ask people, you know, what do you think if I, you know, you're in a crowd of people and Susan is contesting the EPA and delegitimizing the EPA. And you could ask her, so who do you think of the people that would share your view who would be most open to consider alternative perspectives? Now, Susan has to then think about not only who shares her perspective, but who in her group that shares the perspective is most likely to be open to alternatives. So these are, again, ask people to slice and dice their reality in new ways, and they begin, for that reason, they're very powerful for generating change. They're also, we can see in the next slide, that basically circular questions, the relational kind, work in the following way. You want to get Dave to tell you what person X thinks about Y. So your questions would be formulated in that way. Dave, if I were to ask you who in your team or on the committee is most open to any alternatives, most interested in seeking alternatives to the current plan, for instance. And Dave would name who that person is, and then you can have a long conversation about why they think that and where they got their views from, et cetera. So it helps you, again, develop this sort of perspective taking, which is extremely important for undermining conflict narratives. So here are a couple of examples of temporal questions where you could go out 10 years and ask folks what they'd like to see in the community, or what makes that vision different from where you are today. Those are, again, follow-up questions. Examples of relational circular questions. So which groups within your community seem to be the most distraught, right? And et cetera. So what does that tell us about how you see the community, et cetera? So, again, these support a new kinds of analysis of the situation. People give you new information, and they have to take the perspectives of others, which is fabulously interesting. So
we have an activity here, and we have a case study that we'll get to in just a few minutes, and I think that you'll get a lot of benefit out of that. So we're just going to take a couple minutes, maybe like 2 minutes here, to ask you if you can come up with some examples of relational circular questions or temporal, you know, the comparison of time or comparison between people, questions that you have either you've already maybe asked at your sites and you just didn't know that's what they were, or that you could ask to try to shift a conflict narrative. So if you would like to go ahead and type those into the box now, we will wait until you get a few questions in, and then we'll comment on what you have provided. And so it's just to give you an opportunity to try to form those kinds of questions.
And while we're waiting for some to come in there, Sarah and Gina, if a participant isn't sure if it's written in the right way, can they put in their best guess, and perhaps you might give them some suggestions on how to turn it into a relational or circular question?
Absolutely.
Okay, so that box will appear in the lower left side of your screen. You can type in your own responses, and then again, as we start to see some answers coming in from your fellow participants, if you think that that's a good example of this type of a question, you can also hover your cursor over it and click the plus one that should appear next to that question.
And don't be shy. This is for you to learn, so you know, we're not expecting perfection on the first try here. Just give it a shot, and then we can, as Jean just said, we can help with reforming if your question needs a little bit of change.
I think, Elizabeth, your question about why do you feel like nobody cares about your community is a really interesting question, because what you're seeking there is that kind of perspective. You're wanting to dig down and understand what's underneath somebody's view of things. So I really think it's an excellent effort. It's framed in a linear way with a why. So my sense is, my bet would be, that somebody would give you back, when you ask that question, attempting to get at the foundation of the narrative, you'd get back the shortened conflict version of that, which is, you know, why do you feel that nobody cares about your community? Well, because the EPA never has been here, and, you know, they've ignored us for 25 years. So I think you could reorganize that as a, because I understand what you're trying to do, and I think you're on the right track. So it may be something like, I think you feel that nobody cares about your community. And you can make a statement like that, and people are already on the edge of their chair saying, yeah, yes, yeah. They're elaborating. They know that you're elaborating them. So you can make a statement rather than a question. And then the question can come like, well, what? Think of changing why to what. What do you think is behind that? Or what do you think, what gives you that sense? You know, what you're trying to do is not find out if it's the truth or not, but find out what is their, what are they basing their perspective on? So that's a really easy fix to a linear question, and then it can go ahead and function in the way in which I think you've imagined it, which is totally excellent. How about that for positive connotation?
Maybe we can look at one more.
I think, Helen, your question about what EPA can do to make you feel more confident in your work, in the work that they're doing, it's really an interesting question because it seeks to understand yourself through the perspective of the other, and I think that it signals also a very nice relationship that you actually care enough to be interested in that. That's a good one. I'm laughing at Ruth Shards, who says, why does the EPA need to spend, it went away. Why does the EPA need to spend millions of tax dollars on a site that has nothing done for at least 20 years and no one has been harmed by it? So that is a very interesting question, which is a fabulous way to continue the narrative. Again, one of these linear questions, these why questions will jump up and get you, I think, because they end up in some ways reproducing the conflict. So I think she was trying to get at, again, what the perspective of the person she's speaking to would have, and I think that's really underlying is great. That's what relational circular questions do.
Okay, so thanks for playing along, and I hope that was our feedback was helpful. We're going to go ahead and move ahead because we have just a couple more, one more tool to discuss with you, and then we want to give you a chance to apply this to a narrative. So I'll turn it back over to Sarah.
Okay, this is probably the most complicated. That's why it's number three, and I'm just going to describe it briefly and refer you to the narrative guide where it's discussed more elaborate in a more elaborate way. Externalization is a tool that enables you as the conversant to support the reflections of someone on their own experience and the story that they're telling. You can use it to reframe narratives in a way that, you know, actually enables people to feel more powerful, less helpless, and more in control of their situation despite, you know, the constraints that they have. And here's how you do it. You ask somebody to describe to you what's going on, right? And mostly people will just tell you the conflict narrative. But in there, you might be looking for a negative experience. And in particularly, you want negative emotions are fabulous. Fear, anger, being distraught, being afraid, all of that. All those are really good examples for this. And this enables you to get a hold of that term. After you find that word and somebody said it, you then can ask people to tell you what it does to them, to their lives, to their lives. So instead of being about the EPA or the radioactivity, now the conversation is about fear. Where does it come from? How did it get there? You know, what does it do to you? When is it the worst? When is it better? All of that. So the conversation is about the negative experience that people are having. And then asking them to reflect on that, because then that's a way of creating, here we've got already that negative experience externalized. It's now not them, it's something that's impacting them, and that's the externalization. Then it's possible to ask them questions about that. What can you do about it? How do you have any control over that? What do you think some next steps would be? You know, once they've identified it, the way in which it impacts them, they can be the basically doctor, their own doctor, and help themselves find a remedy for addressing that negative experience. Now, of course, they do that in conversation with a supportive person like yourself, and that enables them to feel less at the effect of this thing and more in control of it. So it's a very, very powerful tool, and again, I refer you to the guide for you know, for a deeper explanation of it. Now, and on this slide, I'm just trying to reiterate that basically you want people to be in positions of agency, and particularly people in Superfund sites feel done to, and they have all these strong feelings that this tool would help you help them address. And it really can open up a conversation about how to reduce negative emotions and help people, again, reclaim their own power and able to impact their own lives relative to the experience of their lives, right? It might not change the level of reactivity in their community, but it can help them help themselves on addressing these negative experiences.
And this is Gina. I just wanted to add that, again, this is the fact that we've put it last and haven't spent much time on it doesn't reflect the level of importance, but it does reflect that this is a much more challenging tool to use that requires more practice. And so we put these in the order that we did because we think positive connotations, and I think you've all demonstrated it, is something that's pretty easy to pick up and go out and use. So that's why they're ordered the way they are. I just wanted to note that. And now I want to move to a case study, and really it's a case example. So this comes from the USS-led Superfund site, which is in Region 5, and some or many of you may be familiar with. So I'll just really quickly read this, and you can read along, and then we are going to ask you to use the tools that we have just given you, that we've shared with you, to try to develop your own both positive connotations and circular questions to try to start transforming this conflict. So the Environmental Protection Agency recommends cleaning up the area where the West Calumet housing complex once stood to residential standards. But in a letter to the EPA, Mayor Anthony Copeland suggested the property could be used for commercial or industrial purposes, which could mean the EPA wouldn't have to remove as much contaminated soil. As a result, the EPA has built a contingency into its plan. The cleanup will be to a residential standard unless the city decides to take an offer from a commercial or industrial company later on. At a recent meeting, Sherry Hunter with Calumet Lives Matter says the mayor doesn't care about his residents. I don't know why. We didn't ask for what we're going through, she says. So this comes from an article that you can see the link to it below. But what we're going to ask you to do is you're coming into the situation, you're going to have a conversation with Sherry Hunter. How would you use, starting with positive connotations, how would you use positive connotations to start to transform this narrative? Yeah, I thought we were going to put them up one at a time. Yeah, we can. We've got them both up. So yes, you can type into either box. On the left side, you've got positive connotations, and on the right, circular questions. And so you can develop. So this is something that you would say. So you're kind of creating your own role play here a little bit, or at least one side of it. So you can type in a positive connotation or a circular question in either of the appropriate boxes to try to start shifting this conversation. So we'll give you a few minutes to start sharing your responses, and then we will comment on those as we did earlier. But just remember that a positive connotation is the attribution not of something positive, it's the attribution of positive intention on the part of other people. Not your own. I promise you I'm a good person. But the attribution of positive intentions that other people have. And so in this case, if you're writing as someone from EPA and you're in conversation with, in our example, Sherry Hunter, you're going to be looking to attribute positive intent to her, likely, or to the group, at large, or as a whole. So think about how you might convey that positive intent, or what kind of question you might ask. Coming in. And remember with circular questions to just think about those two different types, the
temporal.
Yeah, the comparison of time. So maybe asking something about comparing the present to future or past to present, and the comparison between people. And so thinking back to the examples where we asked about what do you think this person thinks about this might be one kind of question, and just think about what you're trying to get at there. I think in our example, we had asked about, who do you think is most worried? Who do you think is least worried?
So Elizabeth, your question about the positive connotation side, it looks like you're diligently following the site's progress to protect public health. That is a statement that is fabulous. That's a positive connotation. And usually, and I failed to say, and Elizabeth, you sort of intuitively got it, that a positive connotation can come in a question, but it often comes in a statement form like that, where you're not asking, is this the case? Did you diligently follow? You're saying you did. So that's a really good example. So, Jim, your question about the EPA asking Sherry why she feels that the mayor doesn't care for them, that's got a circular structure to it. You're exactly right, because it's you asking Sherry about her sense of the mayor, right, and how the mayor does or doesn't care about the others. So there are these circles there between perspectives. But you might frame it as something like, if I were to ask you, Sherry, how can you tell me how you think the mayor feels about, you know, these other folks over there, or, you know, whoever them is. Or the EPA, maybe it's the EPA. Is it the EPA?
Yeah.
So I think you could make these circles explicit there. That's a good frame for a question.
And this is a good future-looking question from Connor. What do you think is the future of this community? And you could change that just slightly to make it more of a comparison. So, you know, if what you're getting at is you want to kind of shift the conversation so that Sherry's thinking about what do I want this to look like in the future, and if we're imagining a future where this is, you know, this has been resolved in a way that, you know, the cleanup is over, whatever they're doing is over, what at the end of that, what do you want this to look like? You can ask in a way that explicitly asks that. So it's kind of similar to the question that we asked earlier. And what you really want to get there is, and you might remember the way Sarah kind of kept questioning, like, you want some details about, think about what are you in this future, you know, what is it that you're feeling that's different, and you're assuming you want it to be better, if it's your community, what is it about it that makes it better in the future?
So, Connor, and that, just to follow up with Gina, I think future-oriented questions are great, like, how do we think the future should be? The problem is that it's a wide-open door for the repetition of the conflict narrative. So the difference between a future-oriented question and a circular question is that you're asking people to compare the current present, or the past, with the future. And then to do that, they have to pull out a dimension that we're going to have a conversation about. Well, it's going to be more resilient, or we're going to feel empowered, or we're going to be safer, or whatever it is. Different than, tell me what you think should happen in the future, which is a freeway. It's an on-ramp for the conflict narrative.
All right. So I think that we want to give you all an opportunity to ask questions.
Lots of great questions in there, folks, by the way.
Yes.
Really good.
Thank you. Thank you for so many of you for participating and for sticking with us. I see that we still have quite a few folks on, so we're going to move from this, and I think that we have, that we're opening it up for questions now, but I just want to make sure that, I don't know if you want to say anything on this, Sarah, before we move on to questions.
Gina's point earlier, which is the EPA's story about our own stories that we tell about ourselves, whether we are representatives of the EPA or mothers or fathers or whoever we are, but those stories are going to be critical to how we make sense of the world, and that goes for us and everybody else around us.
So please, if you do have questions, go ahead and send them now, and we will answer as many as we can before we wrap up.
So I'll remind the audience that we do have a Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen. A few of you have submitted questions earlier today, and if you haven't done so, you can go ahead and type in your comments or questions there. But I will ask, for those of you who are only on the phone line, I do know that there's just one or two of you who called in for today. If it's easier for you to ask your questions on the phone, you're welcome to press #6 on the phone to come off of mute, and then feel free to just share your name and ask your question for the speaker. Again, #6 if you're on the phone and would like to ask your question by phone. Okay. While we're waiting to see if some additional questions come in, I'll just start with this first one, which actually was asked by a number of individuals. A lot of people have asked where they can find a copy of the narrative framework guidance that you highlighted earlier in the talk, Gina.
So it's not available online, but I can send it to anyone who is interested. At least, I don't think we've been able to put it on our internet site yet. So they can email me, and I can give you my email address real quick. But I think that also our at the very end, I think on the last slide, my email address is on there too, I believe. But it's CERASANI.GINA@EPA.gov. So if you send me an email and let me know that you would like a copy, I will email it to you right away. I mean, not immediately, but soon, once this is over. But I'd be happy to share it with you.
Okay. Was there another comment?
Well, this is Sarah, and I was just going to ask the group. So if I were to ask
Jean,
who knows the EPA audience, why the group is so quiet about not having any questions. What do you think she'd tell me, group?
I would tell you that many of these are diligent staff members who sadly sometimes get tapped to do a lot of things at their desks when we do webinars. I would also say that some of them have their questions. Sometimes when we have really good instructors, you guys answer the questions as you're going along. So I see them start to type them, and they stop, and they back out.
I don't agree with that.
But we did have a comment that came in from Mark, and perhaps you all can just share your thoughts on this. Mark stated that the circular discussion seems more appropriate in a small group or sort of individual discussion, not necessarily intended for large public meetings. Could you chime in on that thought?
This is Sarah. I think it's a good intuition, Mark, because you want to try to be careful in a very public space where you don't know what the stories are, right? You can ask somebody to do the sort of public gossiping and find new fractures or new divisions in the community, right, that you didn't know were there, and then they come back and bite you in public, right? So, you can get to the point. I feel confident in doing it in large groups, but I also feel confident to pick up the pieces when new fractures and divisions come up. So I think that a great way to do this is in individual interviews or very small groups. I totally agree with you. So I think that's a good intuition.
Okay. And I see another comment coming in here where one of the participants mentioned that they thought that in public meetings they really should be doing listening. And to them, some of these questions sound like they will be doing the talking or sort of shifting the story from the community rather than doing that listening, which was so critical. They wondered if they were missing the point here.
No, they're not missing the point. I think they're actually making an excellent point. I would say that narrative intervention happens after joining, which is, who was the name of the person you mentioned?
Jim.
Pardon me?
It was Jim.
Yeah, Jim's absolutely right, I think. You join first, right? And the way you join from a narrative lens is to elaborate somebody's story. You got to elaborate it. So you'd want to listen, you'd want to pick up key terms, you want to make sure you understand the other's perspectives, you want to be respectful, all those things that I think, Jim, you're right on, you're absolutely intuiting. And you would not engage in positive connotation, circular questions, or externalization, I think, before you actually have joined somebody's narrative. So thank you so much. I'm going to put a new slide in the deck and make sure that we talk about joining before we think about using any of these tools. And what's the breakoff point where you've joined enough and you're ready for evolution? Again, that depends on your level of skill and comfort and what do you think is going on, and your good common sense, which clearly you've got.
All right. Thank you. It looks like Jim also wanted to know, and I think this might be a pretty common one, people were wondering if there was a way to get one-on-one coaching to help practice these styles.
Oh, good question. Yes. So I'm going to shift to another slide in just a moment on the Conflict Prevention and Resolution Center and what we can offer to assist, but we absolutely do coaching, and we can I specifically can provide coaching on this if you're preparing for a meeting or interviews or you want to try these skills, I would absolutely recommend that, and that's something that we can help with.
Okay. I think in the interest of time, we'll take one more question before we go through those final closing reminders and resources with the audience, because we are nearing our scheduled end time of 3 p.m. Eastern. So this last question comes from Elizabeth, and Elizabeth said that during one of the role plays, the EPA person had good positive connotations and a good greeting with a community member, but they never answered their question or statement about why the meetings weren't substantive and why it seemed like EPA was sort of stalling. So how do we address comments that we are stalling when we are not?
Good question. So I think that, you know, first it's always challenging in role play to address everything, and so there one would assume that there is a conversation that goes on and that that actually would need to be addressed in some point. But I totally hear what you're saying about that it could be perceived as an attempt by, you know, asking the question. I'm trying to find this part where that was brought up to see exactly what was said, but that could be perceived that the EPA staffer is trying to avoid answering the question by asking a question. Or so, you know, I think that, again, that's a lot of this is kind of you have to feel it out in the moment. And so if you, what you're getting is, and I think usually a community person who you're in conversation with will probably be fairly direct if they're feeling like you're not answering and say, like, but wait, but I asked you about this thing about stalling and you still haven't answered that. So this shouldn't be used as a way to avoid answering legitimate questions that the community has. But it's also possible that in shifting that conversation a little bit that, you know, that, I mean, stalling is a particular framing, right, within this narrative. And so if the conversation shifts, maybe the conversation isn't about stalling anymore, and maybe it's about something else. So I think that I'd also be open to where that shift takes the conversation and whether, you know, we're kind of assuming now that that person stays stuck there and they want to keep going back there. And that may be the case, but it may actually move the conversation in a new direction where that's not really the concern anymore, or at least not in that moment. Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, the only thing I would add is that I go one down. And you know, if I'm in a mode of trying to support the evolution of a narrative and I get an accusation of this is not addressing the real issues there, come on. Well, I don't want to talk about relationships. I want to talk about feelings. I want to get to solutions, right? Then I would say, you know, I'd go one down. And basically all I say is, you know, I've got one brain and I can only think, I need to understand things thoroughly. So I'm asking these questions to try to foster a thorough understanding on my part. And I wish I was superhuman and could do that pressing a button, but I actually have to talk to people. So I really appreciate your patience. So I just go one down. I can only do so much at a time, and I have to understand things, and this is my little pea brain working, and thank you for your patience. And people are very, very tolerant when you go one down. So, does that help?
I think so. All right. I think perhaps we are just a little bit past 3:30. Is it okay if we go ahead and move on with some of those closing resources, and then we'll go ahead and close out today's session?
Absolutely. Yeah, so this is, I think this actually is the last slide, and so I just wanted to make a quick plug for CPRC and EPA. Hopefully you all know that we're here and we can assist you both in, we just talked a moment ago about coaching. We can also assist you with getting a facilitator for one of your meetings, or if you need some assistance in working with the community. In open houses or any kinds of different, or even planning, you know, I want to engage, but I'm not sure what I want this engagement to look like, and I want to design something. We can help you with the design. And we also provide trainings like these. So feel free to get in touch. I think that's our main number, actually, on the slide. But I'm in the locator. You can look me up and contact me directly. And that's it.
All right. Okay, thank you so very much. With that, let me walk through just a few final reminders before we officially close out today's live broadcast. First, I want to thank all of our presenters and organizers who took time out of their day to share their expertise with us. And I want to thank the nearly 70 individuals who tuned in live for today's broadcast. Our resources, including the presentation content, are already available on the seminar links or resources page. So if you're looking under the middle right of your screen under related URLs, you'll see a window with a number of links. Just click the seminar resources link to select it and then press the browse to button to actually open it up if you'd like to download a copy of the presentation materials from today. Contact information for our presenters is also available on that seminar homepage, and that's where you'll find Gina's email address. So if you too would like a copy of the guide, you can email Gina directly to get a copy. And I would ask each of you to fill out our online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery. One of the important things about that form is that when you fill it out, at the very bottom, you'll be asked to identify yourself with your email address and then check a box to certify you are here for the whole session. As soon as you do those two things and click the submit button at the bottom of the form, you'll then immediately have access to a participation certificate that you can either print out or save for your own records, which will have details for our session, including the dates, the times, and all the basic details that you're usually asked for if you're trying to earn CLPs for a webinar. If you don't check the box and you don't fill out your email address, you will not get one of those certificates. So please be sure to do that part of the form correctly. If you happen to join together in a group, each person can fill out the feedback form on their own, whether they registered individually or they simply joined you in a conference room. So if you did happen to organize and host a viewing party at your location, please be sure to copy that link to the feedback form and share it with those who joined you in the room so they can get their own participation certificate. And as I noted at the start of today's session, today's webinar was recorded, and you will automatically receive an email with instructions on how to replay the recorded version as soon as that session is available. It usually takes us about 1 week to get the archives available, so you can stay tuned in about 7 days for an email from me. So again, a great big thank you to everyone who joined us and stuck with us, as well as for those of you who participated so well in those activities, and again to our presenters and organizers for helping to host today's live broadcast. This will be the formal conclusion for today's session. Thanks so very much for joining us.